This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
This is part two of a two-part podcast. We return to our interview with Miguel Diacaza. In part one, Miguel was all like, I write the fully elite codes, and we was all like, damn.
Yeah, just on the general topic of engineering challenges, it seems like the fact that you're not only creating a giant framework, but you're creating a giant framework to match somebody else's implementation adds sort of another layer of constraint and difficulty. And I'm just wondering how you manage that. I mean, how do you make sure that you're doing what the .NET framework on Windows is doing?
Do you do
that really religiously, or like will you actually mirror a bug in the .NET framework on Windows so that you match their behavior?
I guess it depends really. If people depend on the bug, we will put in the bug, and there's a number of instances where we've done that. Against our purity, our sense of purity and perfection, some engineers really regret that. But sometimes we have to put the bug compatibility in place because that's the right thing to do. And sometimes we just say, you know what, that is broken, and Microsoft needs to fix it. And your code really should cope with that because when they fix it, and chances are they might, your code is not going to work. So it depends. Now, the one thing to keep in mind is that whoever is designing it for the first time and whoever is writing the specs for the first time has an incredibly large burden to come up with that in the first place. So, the people that designed TCP/IP actually had to do a lot of measurement, a lot of evaluation, a lot of bandwidth testing and, congestion detection and analyzing data and traces and so on. They design a protocol that suited those, what their observations and that was efficient for those particular set of observations. But once they encoded that in a protocol and they said, well, this is how IP works, this is how TCP works, the effort of implementing it is a lot simpler. You just go through the specification and say, well, what is it that I need to do? And, you implement that. And that's a lot simpler than, in many cases, it's a lot simpler than actually having to figure out everything else. So, credit where credit is due. Microsoft, it's simpler to just re-implement than to actually come up with the thing in the first place. Now, when it comes to how to make sure that we are compatible, one of the rules that we have in Mono is that when you contribute code, you really need to contribute it with end unit test cases. And those test cases, you have to make them first run on Windows. And once they run on Windows, you write the code and then you contribute both at the same time. You contribute your patch and the test cases. And that helps us make sure that, that we're compatible as to the extent that the test suite is robust enough or complete enough. But most importantly, it prevents us from regressing because as we evolve the code or make changes, fixes, refactoring, and so on, the day-to-day work, we don't want to introduce bugs that were previously fixed. We have continuous build bots and I can't remember how many we have now, but it runs in, probably a dozen different architectures and distributions continuously. So every time we make a commit, it builds the entire Mono on all of these architectures, x86, Spark, S390, ARM processors, and so on. And it runs all of the regression test suites to make sure that we don't that we don't regress. So that's how we do it. It's not perfect, but, and when people find defects, and they do find defects, they send us a bug, and then we have to look into it and create a test case. And, hopefully we can create a unit test case out of it and then implement it. So, it's probably not the most fun part of hacking on Mono, but it's important to do it.
So you were talking about all the different platforms it runs on, and I think that's one of the most magic things to me. And I'm just curious, you were mentioning earlier it runs on your MP3 player, it runs on iPhone, it runs on the Wii, in addition to, large servers. And I'm just wondering how you're able to, how do you pull that off? Is it that these systems are already running Linux-style operating systems? Or
Well, in the case of, for example, Windows is a different beast, right? So we do support Windows, we do support the Mac OS. we do support the Wii and the iPhone. You're right that a lot of them look like Unix. And in fact, you know, one of the debates that we're having right now on the mailing list is that today, to build Mono on Windows, you have to use a Unix toolchain, right? You need to use Cygwin for Windows to get make and set and grep and all of that junk to get it building. So one of the discussions that we're having right now on the mailing list is that we want to provide an F5 experience for Visual Studio developers. So basically, you get the source, you open the solution, you press F5, and you get a full Mono. So that's where we want to go. And, you know, it's one of those things that we know we've underperformed in that area. But it's what that is the thing that was easy. So we just, it was an easy thing to do. It's not perfect, but, you know, you're right that the majority of the things that we port to are Linux, you know, Unix lookalike systems.
So am I correct in thinking that your CLR and your compiler and all of your base class libraries are all written in C#?
Our compiler, our class libraries are all written in C#. Our Visual Basic runtime is written in Visual Basic. And our Visual Basic compiler is written in Visual Basic. The actual VM is built on C. It's pure C. And the Moonlight graphic rendering engine is a combination of C and C++. But other than the C and C++, everything else is managed.
For going back to iPhone just briefly, the way you're pulling that off is that the iPhone prevents managed code from being run because it doesn't allow execution of data segments. So you're uh-huh. statically compiling.
That's right. So we do the equivalent of ngenning, you know, just like Microsoft does ngen. The problem is that ngenning and what we used to do as static compilation in the past they're only partial. They still have a little bit of, you know, tiny little chunks of code that are dynamically generated. And so basically what we had to do was, put a lot of work into making sure that those things that were dynamically generated were statically generated. So the way that we work on the iPhone is exactly that. We statically compile. And the good news is that now that we have static compilation implemented in Mono, this same technology can be used by Xbox developers. That was one of the requests that we got from the gaming industry, basically, which was, Mono is great and C# is great, and being able to use Visual Studio to, you know, build our games and, you know, debug our games is great, but if it doesn't work on the Xbox, we can't really use it. So with this new technology now we can offer to the Xbox industry, you know, a static compiler for managed languages that they can use in there. So it's not only for the iPhone. There were other ulterior motives.
So does that mean then for me there's less call for it now to have a static compiler because Vista's got .NET installed. Is it possible to static compile a .NET application to run on Windows XP?
Yes. Well, I think that what you're trying to solve there is there a way that I can bundle my libraries with, you know, everything that I need from .NET with my code, right? And it's a technicality whether the code is just-in-time compile or, you know, it's pre-compiled for you, right? I don't think that you really care about that. And in fact, the just-in-time compilation has the advantage that it generates better code than pre-compiled code because, you know, just-in-time compiled code can actually take advantage of your CPU and optimize for your CPU. And ahead-of-time compile needs to assume, you know, a common denominator. So in the particular case that you're describing, we have a tool called mkbundle that will do exactly what you want. It will bundle all of the assemblies and your code into, you know, one executable, and you can distribute that to your customers, and they will never know that they're running with a .NET environment. To them, it's just a gigantic .exe file, and it contains everything inside. The reality is that it's still jitting the code that is inside. For the iPhone and the Xbox, due to technical limitations and requirements on the operating systems, you have to do the full static compilation. By the way, there's a couple of commercial products that do the similar bundling thing using .NET. I can't remember their names, but there's a couple of commercial products that will bundle pieces of .NET with your app exactly in the way that you want.
Yeah, I remember reading about some of them. They were, I think, around like $1,500 or so.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, Mono is free, so, you know.
Yeah.
So a while back, we had a guy named Ted Leung on, and I kind of asked him about, you know, how corporations can interact with open source communities, and because that's starting to come into a play with Microsoft. They've been hiring a lot of people that have been active in the .NET open source community, like Phil and Hammett and some other people. And there's a lot of groundswell support for .NET open source products. And so I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on how Microsoft is acting or interacting with the open source community that's kind of building up around its .NET framework. And because you've been on both sides. So you've been at a large company that's kind of embraced open source at Novell. And then you've worked with Microsoft directly with not competing open source product, but an open source product, the implementation of one of their products.
Yeah, I think that, so the open source has always had, you know, there's always, you know, you can't really say that open source serves one particular agenda. There's a number of agendas that play with open source. There's certainly one that is what matters to individuals, which is, do I get to do whatever I want with my code or not, right? Or the code that I got, can I make changes to the code? Can I redistribute the code once I make changes? Is it legal for me to do so? So there's that particular angle. You know, consumers care about, you know, getting better software faster, cheaper. That's another angle. But, you know, there's from the corporation point of view or the original contributor, there's other agendas that are very interesting. One is, for example, in some cases, you might have a good idea, but you don't have the staff to make it happen, right? You don't have all the resources that you would like to, or the experience, or the time to make it happen. So if you think that you can lead an effort and basically, you know, coordinate and do that work, you can definitely get a lot of work done that way. You know, you have to accept that the code is not going to be yours, that it's going to be a shared property, and that you get to use it, but anybody else gets to use it. But as long as you're okay with that idea, you know, that's a viable way of using open source. Another one is getting your technologies adopted. And I think that starting to build sample, that's what I think that it was brilliant for Microsoft to start, you know, publishing their samples as open source, because it means that developers don't have to worry about the fact that they copy-pasted some code from Microsoft or a sample from Microsoft and build their product around it. Microsoft is in the business of selling operating systems, and you know, the more people that use their stuff, the better. So, you know, that's another agenda, trying to get adoption for your APIs and for your technologies and your frameworks and so on. So it's a strategic decision at some point that you have, you know, that somebody makes is, well, this piece is worth open sourcing because it will drive revenue to other pieces, or this piece is not worth open sourcing. And sometimes it's a matter of trying to get traction. I mean, you might have created a fantastic idea, but the fact that you have a fantastic idea doesn't mean that the market will accept it. And if you open source a technology, it gives you, it's a major obstacle that you take away from adoption. So if you're interested in getting a standard or, you know, a specification or, you know, a protocol or something like that adopted, open sourcing the technology, I think, is a great idea. And in fact, I suggested to Microsoft a few things that I think they should open source, you know, because it would help them. It would not help us. It would, in fact, make Windows more popular. But, you know, if I were at Microsoft, I would be open sourcing a lot of other stuff. You know, I would be open sourcing a lot of the, you know, of the components that Microsoft is not making money on Vista, for example. Just a sample code of, you know, showing best practices or how to build the software correctly, that sort of thing. So you have all of these different, I mean, open source is, you know, it's a means to an end, but it depends who you ask what the means are, you know, what the end is, right? Different people will give you different answers. So I think that Microsoft has been, you know, it's becoming very sophisticated in its adoption of open source. I think there were a couple of trial balloons with Iron Python, and in fact, or Wix, right? And actually, it's interesting to look at the kind of the evolution of the same group that started pushing, you know, to make Iron Python open source, because it was initially under this open source-ish license, and that eventually led to the MSPL, which became OSI certified. So, you know, the open source people and the Free Software Foundation people gave it the stamp of approval. But they've kept expanding, you know. Microsoft lawyers, my understanding is that they were very resistant to taking outside contributions. And, you know, now Iron Ruby is hosted on a public server, is no longer hosted internally at Microsoft, you know, as the master repository. They're finally taking contributions to the library, and I don't know if they're taking to more pieces, but, you know... obviously, Microsoft is evolving, and it's interesting for a company that was historically so opposed to the notion. It's something that other companies have gone through, and I think that every company needs to have a clear defined process of what you open source, when do you open source, why you're open sourcing, when do you take external open source into the company, under which conditions, and for what products, and under what circumstances. So, you know, Novell has those processes in place. I'm sure IBM does, and I'm sure other companies do. And I'm sure that Microsoft is in the process of building those things. So it's you know, I think we're in the early days to, you know, if somebody wanted to write a book about the evolution of Microsoft as a company, right now is a great time to start interviewing people like Hugonin and you know, Phil Hack and all of the other players that are actually very close to where this is happening. And you know, I am convinced, and I have no data to back this up, absolutely no evidence, but I am convinced that Scott Guthrie, which is, you know, he's a web guy, he's a guy that is all about interop, a guy about, you know, he understands the value of HTML standards, interop, mix and match, PHP, C, Glue, Perl, you know, and whatever else. I think that having Scott in charge of the developer platform is probably one of the reasons why Microsoft is adapting so well to this change. I have nothing to back it up, but, you know, it just feels right that the web guy is the guy driving this. So I have no clue if he's the guy, but, you know, he has the charisma and he has the background to be the person doing that, so... So I don't know if that answered the question, but I got really inspired.
Well, it definitely does make some sense to me. And from things I've heard, there have been initiatives that have been directly, people have said that was Scott Guthrie's thing. He made that happen and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's interesting thinking of that, the idea of difference between the web focus and more the desktop platform focus, where I think there's more kind of, I'm thinking back to like the domino theory with, you know, the way that the US reacted towards communism early on with the idea that any loss, you know what I mean? Where it was like, and
yeah.
And
that is a very good analogy.
I think now people, you know, they'll look at it and I don't think that people at Microsoft think, you know, if Beagle gets a little better or F-Spot gets better, we're going to lose X number of customers. I think that it's just kind of the idea that, you know, this may incrementally enhance the experience for some Linux users, but it's not all out war. It's kind of a, you know, in some ways it's cooperative.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I was once reading, you know, I'm a big fan of Noam Chomsky, and at some point, some journalist asks him, you know, they go to Chomsky and they say, "So, Mr. Chomsky, you talk a lot about what's wrong with this and that. What is the right model of government? You know, which one is it? You know, tell us the answer." And he said, "Well, You know, I don't think that that we know the answer to that. I think that we've experimented a lot of things, and I think that there's a lot of room for experimentation. And he went and quoted a couple of things he liked about, you know, every system of government. But I like that idea that, you know, I don't think we have an answer to everything. And you know, it's worth experimenting on different directions, different models. You know, the web just came in and changed a lot of people's, you know, assumptions about what software was, what do you charge for, what ownership, or, you know, when do you use it, that sort of thing. And it just seems that it's the beginning of, I think we're going to be, us as programmers, we're going to have to be relearning a lot, and we're going to have to change a lot of our assumptions in the coming years. I think this is just the beginning. You know, it's just like music, only, what, 5 years ago, you know, if you... The idea of obtaining music online was unthinkable, and now you can just pay, you know, $10 to a company, and you get all the music you can hear for as long as you want during the month. I mean, you know, now you can rent music. You know, I think we're, a lot of assumptions are going to change, and it's fascinating. I'm ready for all the mess that this is going to be.
So the codecs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the codecs.
So there are, I mean, there are existing Windows codecs or codecs for Windows audio and video files out there for Linux. I think VLC has a lot of stuff bundled in, because it seems like whenever I need to play something on OS X, I just install, you know, VLC, and it plays almost everything I need.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering why you made the decision to go, well, made the decision, or why you went with codecs provided by Microsoft instead of, you know, using one of these other codec files out there.
Yeah, so there are certainly open source implementations of the codecs, and for pretty much anything under the earth. And, you know, some of them are better than others. And for the case, anyways... So, you know, there's a lot of those implementations out there. The complexity comes from, for us to, if we wanted to distribute this legally without getting in trouble, you know, for patent infringement and, you know, having a consortium of companies go and knock in the doors of our customers and every Linux user and so on, we needed to work within the framework, you know, within the framework that is in, you know, that exists right now in the United States. And there's basically all the media, all the patents related to VC1, WMV, H.264, MP3, well, not MP3, you know, MPEG and so on, they're licensed by a consortium called the MPEG-LA. And, you know, they charge a per unit fee or per number of units shipped fee. And if you don't pay those things, then, you know, they reserve the right to go visit your customers and get you in trouble or get yourself in trouble. So, you know, the problem with VLC is that I think that for individuals, you know, an individual, it, you know, can take the risk. And I don't think MPEG-LA is going to go after any individuals. I mean, I don't know if they will, but, you know, it just doesn't make a lot of business sense. But, you know, let's say that, you know, let's say a large corporation decides to deploy Moonlight. And, you know, they want to use it on all their Linux desktops. Then we couldn't really tell these guys, well, you know, we know that MPEG-LA is actively licensing these things, and we did not license this. And, you know, as such, you know, you have to deal with them. So the answer would be, well, we're not going to adopt your system, right? So the reason why we couldn't use the GPL implementations is... because the GPL requires the license. The GPL requires that if you own a patent or you have obtained rights to the patent, that you transfer those same rights to the recipients of the code, right? So if we were to redistribute FFmpeg and we became licensors for MPEG-LA, right? So if we go to an MPEG-LA and we obtain a license, you know, and we say, okay, we'll give you, you know, a peso or 10 pesos for each version that we distribute, and we redistribute that, then we would be in violation of the GPL because, you know, the recipients would not have gained the same rights that we did. So that's a problem with GPL and codecs. licensing patents and the GPL doesn't mix, so we couldn't really, you know, distribute that legally. So we had to go, you know, Microsoft was actually really, you know, they really stepped up to the plate and said, all right, we'll provide a codex. We will deal with MPEG-LA, and there's a bunch of other licensors for all the other codecs. So they are dealing with that. So what happens with Moonlight is that you do not get, you know, you do not get the codec from us. When you download Moonlight, you actually have to, you know, after you install it, it basically will go on and tell you if you want to download the Microsoft Media Pack, and it will go and fetch it from Microsoft. So Microsoft is the person that actually has to go and deal with all of the patent licensing. We don't deal with the patent licensing. And in the end, the end user is, you know, has a fully licensed set of codecs. They're not skimping on paying anyone or anything like that. So does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I know that it was not popular, but you know, that's the only way we could make it, you know, fully legit for getting adopted.
So I've got two questions with that. So do you think that the agreement that Microsoft had in place with Novell kind of made the greasing the wheels to get the codecs to you guys a little bit easier?
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, if we had no agreement, I mean, this whole thing, you know, I really need to thank, you know, I don't think that Bob Muglia gets enough credit, but, you know, I really need to thank Bob Muglia, which, you know, when we demoed this stuff to him, he was really excited to see, you know, a Silverlight implementation on Linux terms for Linux. It's Silverlight in our terms, in as much as we human, you know, we could, given the codecs, and to Brian Goldfarb, that you know, it's one of Scott's peers, and to Scott, of course. So you know these guys really did a lot of work to make this happen and to make the collaboration happen, and it all happened within this framework of the Microsoft Novell collaboration. As I say, you know, it's usually when you read one of these announcements between two companies agreeing to collaborate, very little shows up. You know, 2 years after the agreement, there's very little to show about what happened. And I was very excited to see that this was not, a completely empty, collaboration agreement. That this actually had, had some interesting side effects and produced a lot of new code. So yeah, definitely the agreement definitely helped make this happen.
So the other thing is, by having Moonlight use these codecs that you have to download from Microsoft, does that pretty much prevent the inclusion of Mono in a pure OSS, pure GPL, or whatever they call it, distribution like Debian?
Well, the codecs you can't distribute, because if you distribute them, then you need to deal with MPEG-LA. So, you know, distributions will have to figure out what that means. My recommendation is you just get Moonlight and then just download the codecs once you're done and get them from Microsoft. In fact, I would say that most Linux distributions have this cute little hack where you're probably not familiar with this because you guys are in Windows. But in Linux, we don't have the nice TrueType fonts like Arial and Trebuchet and, you know, those fonts that come with Windows. And what happened is that Microsoft actually published those fonts many years ago for public consumption. But there was a restriction. It had no redistribution rights. So you couldn't really distribute that as part of the OS. You could fetch it from the web, but you could not install it with the OS. So what pretty much every Linux distribution does is they have this package called MS Core TT Fonts, or something along those lines. And when you install that package, what the installer does is it actually goes and fetches the file from the network and then installs the package. Because you don't have redistribution rights, but you have the rights to use it. If you just don't have the rights to redistribution. So you know, my advice is just to do something along those lines, to completely, you know, and then that way you can avoid the entire discussion with MPEG-LA, for example.
That's something I've actually wished that Microsoft would do, and you talked a little bit about that before with the whole apt-get thing that Microsoft doesn't have right now. But that gets around so many of these problems, you know, like there are applications that there are open source applications that Microsoft won't distribute because they don't want to take on the liability for it, but they could do the same thing with, you know, paint.net or whatever else. Just make it something that you can, you know, click a button and go get it the same way that you get those codecs.
Yeah, that's actually, so that's the reason they don't distribute paint.net. Well, and I'm sure other stuff. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. They should have something like that. You know, some sort of a software catalog that you can use. But yeah, that's the way we work around it. And, you know, I think it would be good if Microsoft did something like that too.
You were talking earlier about the media, and I just had a question about that. Like, the way that you're doing, I read your posts about that before, about how you were handling the media, and that it's complex because the way Silverlight handles the video is that it can be used as a brush, or it can be transformed, or it can be skewed, or whatever. With audio, they don't give a lot of control over audio, and really that's not the whole .NET platform doesn't have much control over audio.
Jesus, yes, that is a weak. Yeah, it's kind of weak. Yeah, I agree.
Very weak. What do you end up just like do you delegate out to an audio API for all that, or you know, the
yeah.
amount?
Yeah, so what you do is, I mean, the programmer surface, which is what the Silverlight developer gets, is basically media element, right? And you give it a URL, and all the control you really have is sync, play, and stop, roughly, right?
Right.
Play, and stop. And so once you do that, you know, after we decode that information, you get the raw PCM data. I have no idea what PCM means, but everybody calls it PCM. And, you know, you just shove that into your audio device. Now, in the typical Linux fashion, you know, we have a number of competing standards for how you get the PCM data from your application to the actual to the actual speaker. And that is probably one of the most painful pieces of code in Moonlight. It was not the graphics. It was not the. It was not the performance. It was not the streaming. It was not, you know, the spec, the bugs. It was actually dealing with all the combinations of audio and broken audio and less broken audio, and the fact that Solaris has one, FreeBSD has another one, and Linux has, you know, a dozen to choose from. So. You know, it's not great, but but once you pick what you're going to do, you know, you just send the PCM data to the speaker and you're done with that. I wish Silverlight had better, you know, better audio control, in general, or .NET, but that's not the case today. You know, stuff like, you know, it would be nice to have access to MIDI events, get data from the MIDI bus, sending data to the MIDI bus, playing samples, you know, better timing, you know, being able to queue samples at specific times and let the runtime take care of it. I would like to be able to use Silverlight to build, you know, a professional music recording application. And today, I guess you can do some of it, but it's going to be challenging. And there's no reason why it should be challenging. It should just work. So, you know, I think we need to lobby Microsoft and, you know, push for that to make it into the standard. And maybe what we could do is we could prototype that in Moonlight and then just say, well, if the Mono guys did it, you know, something along those lines. And, you know, another thing that is interesting is that with Silverlight 2, they've made a few interesting things with this thing they call adaptive streaming, where you can actually plug into the pipeline for media. So you can actually fetch the data from multiple sources, reassemble it if you want, and then handle it to the pipeline. But today the pipeline expects this data to be encoded, and in one of the formats that you want. What would be nice is if the pipeline that raw a lot for raw audio, you know, just sending PCM data, and that would give you, you know, that would give you a lot more than what you have today. It would be very nice. Anyways, I'm sure that John Galloway is very excited about this.
That's something I've tried to play with a lot of times, and I just keep hitting dead ends.
Yeah.
Yep.
Understood.
Just curious what you thought was fascinating at the PDC.
Fascinating at the PDC. Let me think. What was fascinating? So I really like Mesh. I wish some of that was, some of the protocols and the specifications were published so we could have an open source implementation of Mesh. My understanding is that some of that stuff is coming up. C# 4 is always refreshing. You know, it's always good to listen to Anders. So I really like that. PEX was, there were a lot of talks that I didn't get to see at the PDC because, you know, two things. I was freaking out over my presentation, and two, you know, I usually do the hallway session. But in retrospect, I think that the things that I really enjoyed were Phil Hack and his presentation on ASP.NET MVC together with the Stack Overflow presentation. I think that was great. I really, really enjoyed the dynamic language talk. I thought they went through, they had a lot of depth. I enjoyed Jim Hugunin as always. I think those are, those technologies, Microsoft has been talking about them for a while, but it's nice to see them finally mature. They're finally coming together. They're no longer a 1.0, they're no longer a prototype. But they're now, finally getting, their complete offerings. And so those were really interesting talks. The ASP.NET talk with Jeff and Phil, the Hugunin, John Lamb, I like those ones. The PEX presentation, I cannot remember their names. It's Mike, and I forget the name of the other presenter. That was great. The work on parallel computations, again, another presentation that I saw afterwards. I think it's fascinating. I just bought this cheapo computer from the web, and it comes with 4 CPUs, and I'm kind of a cheap bastard. So, I just bought a new server for home, for storing files, and it comes with 4 CPUs. I think that in 2-3 years, we're going to have machines with 16 CPUs, and the question is how we're going to start taking advantage of those features. So, I think that's great work. So I think those were the things that interest me most about the PDC. The Azure stuff, I don't really understand it. It doesn't run on Linux yet, so I guess everybody's excited about the cloud. I'm a desktop guy, so I'm not much of a cloud developer yet. So I don't really have an opinion yet on that stuff.
So you mentioned MVC and Phil's stuff. Is there work going on to bring the MVC APIs to Mono?
Oh, that is a very good question, and I wish that Phil Hack would give me some clarity on that. They have released the source code to ASP.NET MVC under one of those Microsoft bad licenses. So, I'm trying to, before we embark ourselves into implementing MVC, I want to understand if they're even going to open source them. Because if they do, then I'd rather not waste cycles. So I guess I'm going to wait until ASP.NET MVC 1.0 comes out. And if the license doesn't change by that time, then we'll implement it. And the reason for kind of waiting for the 1.0 release is that, we know that there are not going to be any more API changes, or at least, once a product ships, it's a lot harder. So that means that we also would waste less cycles. So once ASP.NET MVC 1.0 comes out, either the code becomes open source and then we live happily ever after, or we have to go and implement it. Now, somebody told me, and I have not verified this, but apparently the source code license is not great, But the binary license doesn't have any platform limitations, which means that you can actually use the binary, and I know of a few people using the binary today with Mono on Linux. So, you know, I think that's a good, you know, that's a good proof of how well Mono has evolved over time, that you can actually use Microsoft ASP.NET MVC today with Linux. So, you know, I really wish they open sourced it so I don't have to reimplement it. But on the other hand, you know, two of the ASP.NET hackers on the team, they're kind of wishing Microsoft doesn't open source it because they really want to build it. So, you know, my opinion is we got, you know, if we can, we can work on other stuff. But, you know, they're kind of, you know, Jackson and Marek are kind of, you know, they really want to build it themselves. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But, you know, I'm very excited about ASP.NET MVC. Because it's going to make I really believe that it's going to bring ASP.NET a little bit closer to, you know, where the mindset of web developers is today, which is, you know, very lightweight HTML, a lot of control over the HTML, and a lot of control over what gets generated. And that's not what you get today with ASP.NET web forms. There's too much magic there for this new generation of web apps. So I think that people really want to have, you know, access low level, very little, you know, auto-generated stuff and build everything themselves.
And how about some of the C# 4 stuff, especially the dynamic stuff?
Oh, that stuff. Yeah. Marek actually has, you know, we've looked at that stuff. There's a few things that are not yet entirely cooked. So we want to wait on those features. The features that are less controversial or the ones that, you know, seem a lot easier to implement, we're probably going to get to implementing those relatively soon. But, you know, on our website, on the Mono Project roadmap, we do have dates for when we're planning on adding those C# 4 features. I just don't remember them off the top of my head right now. But, here it is. So we're planning on having a dynamic by September. For a September release, so rough about a year from now.
Yeah, before Microsoft.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. Well, the other thing is that a lot of the support for dynamic actually comes from the DLR. I don't know if you noticed that in the presentations, but a lot of it comes from the DLR, and we've talked to the DLR team, and, you know, they're committed to keeping it open source and keeping the public version as the official version of it. So a lot of the C# 4 runtime support is actually being, you know, is being done by Microsoft, and it's done in an open source way. So, you know, we'll leverage a lot of that stuff. You know, the only thing that where I think it's going to be a little bit unfortunate is the fact that today we have our API for our compiler service, and Microsoft has their API for their compiler service, and there's really no communication between us. So on that area. So we're going to have to, chances are we're going to have, you know, just because of the market size of Microsoft, we're going to have to reshape our API to look like the Microsoft API when it comes out. You know, not a big deal, but, you know, we'll deal with it. It's not the end of the world.
So this goes back to something we were talking about a long time ago, but it's obvious, you know, Microsoft is building .NET to sell Windows licenses, and customers are using Mono in some really cool ways. Like there's the Sansa MP3 player you were talking about. There's people are building games on Wii. There's iPhone development. There's all kinds of things that people can do. But I'm wondering what's the way in which Novell profits off of the effort.
Oh, we sell a version of Linux Go. Well, there's a couple of ways, but the most important one is we sell our own version of Linux Go, SUSE Linux Enterprise, and you know, we run your .NET applications on Linux, specifically ASP.NET applications, you know. So that's one of them. The other thing is that Mono is open source, released under the terms of the GNU LGPL, and the problem is. The GNU LGPL doesn't really blend well with the license terms and agreements that you need to sign with the Xbox or the Wii or the PlayStation guys. So for those particular cases, you do need to license the Mono runtime under non-LGPL terms. So we do sell those licenses to those people. And there's also another class, but, you know, we're planning on just making, you know, I think we're just going to make it free. It's just not worth the effort, which is when people statically link Mono, because, it, you know, again, the gaming industry wants to do that because they don't want people to modify their code on the client and cheat, right? Like sending, you know, this guy has, you know, 100 weapons. So they want to statically link, right. You know, Mono and the libraries with their application. And right now, to do that, you need to license from Novell. But, you know, it's very cumbersome. So we're just thinking, I mean, right now our mindset is probably we'll just make that free. And, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, it's going to be a special exception to the LGPL just for these people. So anyways, time will tell. But the important ones are right now the embedded OS licensing for games and the SUSE Linux Enterprise. Really, those are the two big ones. So anyways, so that's how we make money. I wish we made more money, but you know, I can't complain.
Guys, any other questions? I'm just about all out.
We could have some gossip about Jeff Atwood, you know.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I remember when I met you and Phil at that mix, that was a lot of fun. That was a great mix.
That was great. That was so funny. I remember you wrote something on your blog saying, I'm going to mix. And Phil and I were big fans of yours back then. And Phil just was like, hey, I'll just write to him and say, yeah, we'll meet you at Mix. And I'm like, really? You're going to do that? You know? And so, yeah, I remember just meeting up, and I remember we were talking, and Phil said something about a Brazilian soccer, and you're like, oh, just a minute, I have to hire the Brazilian.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know who the Brazilian is, the guy that did SIMD.
Oh, really? That's the guy?
That's the guy. The guy that implemented SIMD is a Brazilian. Oh, isn't that amazing? Yeah, that was a great hire. Great hire. Absolutely great hire. Oh, good times. Good times. Well, I certainly hope to see you guys at the conference.
Yeah. Yep. I'll make it there somehow or other.
All right. Well, guys, thank you very much for the time.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Miguel. This is really
cool. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye, guys. Ciao. Have a good one.
All right. Okay. Bye. Thanks for joining us.